You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Hello, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, coming to you in a conversation that's being recorded live in the flesh in Tokyo on November 15th, 2016. And today we are joined by Nomi Prinz of NomiPrinz.com, who you should know by now, but in case you don't, she is a prolific author of not just nonfiction books, but also historical fiction, which I will confess I have not read, although I'm highly intrigued, but she is the author of books like It Takes a Pillage and All the President's Bankers, which, again, if you have not read, this is an incredibly valuable tome on the history of the Federal Reserve and banking in the United States generally over the past century. It's a hefty tome, but well worth the read. Here she is, Nomi Prinz. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, James.
All right. I want to start with an observation. Obviously, we're here in November 2016. Having just seen the presidential election cycle come to its gripping finale. And I want to start with an observation you made in the preface, actually, of All the President's Bankers. You said, I learned that some records, when talking about the records that you wanted to access regarding the relationship between various presidents and the bankers, I learned that some records may never be uncovered without the benefit of Freedom of Information Act requests, not merely for national security reasons. As years go on, the number of redactions and documents rise anyway, but because the commitment to organize such a vast amount of material is not what it was before the 1980s. As such, the bulk of information that might be revealed by the FOIA requests that I filed at the Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Clinton libraries is not available yet. And here we are in the Bush Senior / Obama, now into the Trump presidency. Is there any sign that that state of affairs is going to become any better in this foreseeable future, in the sense that researchers obviously need access to those documents to put together the type of very detailed history that you do in this book?
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that a lot of the information that is in that book before the Reagan years came from physical documents, not so much emails. And of course, emails have been a big part of the last election. They've been discussed ad nauseum in a lot of manners. And because of just the electronic nature of information, and also because of the funding of the way that these libraries, these historical archives actually exist today, it's very hard to get information. Like when I was at the Clinton Library in Arkansas, and I did file a bunch of requests, the way it worked there was that certain requests had been opened, but they were for things like, what did Oprah say to the Clintons? You know, so things that were more commonly asked for were actually open files, but then a lot of things like what happened in the Glass-Steagall Act perspective, you know, what was Robert Rubin saying in the Treasury Department to Bill Clinton and so forth at the time in the late 90s was a lot harder to get at. And I think it will be more and more hard to get at, because even then there were still letters going back and forth. And now everything almost is electronic. And so what happens from a national security perspective is that every single email has to be checked like a million different times to decide whether or not it can even be in an archive. But then there have to be physical librarians that can actually access that information as well, and there's just not as many for the new types of information. So where it was so easy to get a really solid history of communication, like the Eisenhower years or Jimmy Carter or FDR, I think going forward it's going to be near impossible to get actual internal information for all these presidents going forward.
Maybe you'll need to go to the NSA for the real story.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum. And of course, that's even from an historical perspective about things that have been done. But of course, now the question is, well, what about things that are happening at the moment? And of course, we're looking at the Trump transition into the presidency. What do we know and what do we not know about Trump and his connections to the banking community?
Well, Trump, well, for one thing, in terms of information, we know that Trump isn't very good at disclosing information. So what we just discussed relative to what's going to happen in the future and what we will know about Trump is going to be even more limited than what we knew during the election campaign period. We do know that Trump's whole family goes back to mostly the 70s in terms of when he became the start of who he is in terms of working with his father, Fred Trump, and getting loans for developing different types of real estate projects within, not just within New York, but within other cities. And that in New York, though, there was an interesting story that I talk about in All the President's Bankers, not knowing Trump would become president, but one of the things that happened in New York in the 70s was there was a major crisis from a debt perspective in New York. And what had happened was the banks had decided that they weren't going to extend additional lending to New York as New York wasn't able to basically pay on their debt. And there were conversations going on with the big banks like Chase and Citibank at the time, because one of the major places that they were giving loans to was actually to the Trump family, to the Trump organization. And they were actually deciding whether or not they should forgive Trump's loans while they were not allowing the loans to New York City itself be extended. And there's that famous headline from Ford that says, you know, basically, you know, dear New York, drop dead, or something of that nature. And that was basically saying that the government wasn't going to bail out New York. Meanwhile, the banks in New York, which were also not going to bail out New York, were discussing bailing out Donald Trump. So the relationship with banks actually goes back quite a number of decades, even before, you know, he became, president. And also, though, he's certain development projects he's had. For example, I worked for Goldman Sachs, as people may know, before I quit to become a journalist. And one of the places I actually lived when I moved from London to New York was on one of the Trump buildings on the west side of New York. And that was where Goldman and a lot of other corporations put people who were in transition, moving back to the city or into the city or for temporary housing. You know, so you have the big name of Trump, and then you have the corporate relationships between things like Goldman Sachs and other banks putting people into the Trump building. So there's certainly relationships throughout. Trump also, and we don't know at this point who he's going to choose to be his Treasury Secretary, but one of the people that's been most consistent during his campaign was a former Goldman Sachs partner named Steve Mnuchin, who subsequently became a big private equity person. He was one of the, his company bought up a lot of the loans from IndyMac, which was a California-based mortgage company that was one of the first to have problems in the beginning of the subprime crisis. And he bought them really cheap and restructured them and screwed a lot of people out of their mortgages and stuff along the way. But he was very much a part of Trump's campaign, and almost more consistent than a lot of other individuals who were in and out or fired or resigned or whatever from the Trump campaign as it was moving along. And he's one of the names for a potential Treasury Secretary position. So Trump does have a connection to Goldman, possibly, and also, one of the names that was mentioned, not necessarily from Trump having reached out to him personally, but his transition team was Jamie Dimon, who's a Democrat, and who's also the CEO and chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase, and arguably the most powerful banker in the world right now. So it's not like Trump doesn't have tremendous lines from a lending perspective, from a personality perspective, and a relationship perspective. He just downplayed them to his supporters and relative to Hillary Clinton during the campaign period.
Of course. Well, we do concentrate on the big American banks and the Federal Reserve because they have been drivers of global markets in the era of Pax Americana. But we are shifting, or at least we're starting to see the beginnings of a shift into a different era in which it is conceivable that the Federal Reserve will not be the main driver. And you have written about this. I know you're writing about it in your forthcoming book, The Artisans of Money. But You wrote a very interesting little article that, of course, I'll link in the show notes for people to read for themselves. It's called The Central Bank Power Shift from West to East, Game of Thrones Style. And in that, you start to talk about the way that the People's Bank of China and the ECB and other players are having more of an influence on events and how that could shape the world that we're going to be living in. And in fact, in a sense, make some of the Trump presidency, Treasury, Federal Reserve wrangling not as central to world events as one would have thought in a previous era. On that note, you write, for example, the Fed clings to the status quo. Other central banks are vying to knock it down or at least loosen its grip on them. But the Fed behaves as if it has no idea there are other powerful central banks that want to grab and harness its power. It carries on refusing to acknowledge that there may come a time sooner rather than later where its power is attacked. That's, I think, an astute observation, but still maybe an unorthodox one, or at least one that isn't being talked about enough. Where is the Federal Reserve's power being attacked, and by whom?
I mean, I think the biggest attacker or competitor for Federal Reserve's power is the People's Bank of China, as I talked about in that article, and in general, because what was going on in the post-crisis period as the Federal Reserve was creating a coordinated global effort to keep rates at zero, and in cases now, and the ECB has them at negative, the Bank of Japan has them at negative, was to effectively support the financial system of the United States in the beginning of the post-crisis period and throughout, because we're still in a period of effectively zero interest rates. And even though quantitative easing that the Fed created is sort of over, the book of debt, the book of securities that the Fed bought is intact. So it's still a policy that's very much created by the Fed and is still implemented and maintained by the Fed. But during the period where quantitative easing was occurring, where zero interest rates was continuing, the People's Bank of China had a lot of very public statements against this idea, against the notion that if you basically feed, and I'm paraphrasing, but if you feed liquidity or cheap money into all of the markets, that it creates bubbles, it creates unnecessary speculation, that it isn't necessarily a value to any kind of real economic growth or infrastructure building or long-term sustainability. And as a result, the People's Bank of China was talking about how the Fed was being a little bit irresponsible. And that was one of the reasons why the renminbi, the Chinese currency, is now part of the IMF's basket. Right now, the SDR basket, which is new, which just happened as of October 2015, but it was in play for a number of years, because if you're China and all of a sudden you have a financial crisis that occurred outside of your control and a banking crisis that led to that outside of your control and a Federal Reserve that's dictating monetary policy throughout the world, what's the alternative? The alternative is to bring your currency more into play and to criticize that very policy. And that's exactly what they've been doing and what they've been able to accomplish. And the question is how other central banks get onto that framework. And they might not get on from a policy perspective yet, but from an ideology perspective going forward, they can certainly step back and say, all right, well, in the sort of next phase when we're not at zero interest rates, how can we position ourselves so that we aren't required to basically behave from a monetary policy perspective like the Fed behaves and wants us to behave.
Now, you mentioned the central banks that are wrangling for position in this new order, as it were, of the banking system. But in fact, it's not just central banks. You identify the International Monetary Fund as an increasingly right. important, almost like a lever of power that different central banks are vying to control. And the PBOC, of course, I think quite famously, from the point of the 2008-2009 crisis, arguing for the SDR to become a world reserve currency. The People's Bank of China governor has explicitly argued for that. You write in the article, under Lagarde, the IMF is doing more than funding development projects and supplying overall currency directives to the world, as was its original mandate. It is reconstructing new alliances amongst countries not involved in its creation. In doing so, it is building its own power by elevating their allies. It's a fascinating concept. Tell us a little bit about the IMF and its changing allegiances.
Right. So in the beginning, when the IMF and the World Bank were created as development banks, they were created after World War II, and they were created, the IMF in particular, was a partnership really between the U.S. and Europe that's always been run. Its president has always been a European. When Lagarde became president, actually became the head of the IMF, actually there was some potential pushback to that. Carstens, who is a central bank head in Mexico, was vying for that position, courted Tim Geithner and other people in Washington to try to get it, didn't, because it was very much that old school sort of European-U.S. alliance. But under Lagarde and in this shifting post-crisis dollar-based but weakening type of an environment, the IMF has really elevated itself relative to the World Bank in terms of being able to dictate how central banks act and to have a real opinion against the Fed. It was Lagarde who basically said when Yellen was thinking about raising rates, for example, to begin with, and the Fed's in a catch-22 on rates anyway, which is a separate component of the conversation, but she was very vocal and public in saying, well, you can't because it will hurt the emerging markets. You can't because it will hurt and create more instability in the world, and you have to wait, and there has to be a timing issue. So elevating herself and the IMF into the position of dictating that kind of, or at least trying to dictate the timing of monetary policies is very new. And what's also new is this idea of China coming in, as I was talking about before, and having a position in the SDR. And if the IMF is able to have more bonds associated with linking to the SDR being issued in SDRs, then all of a sudden it becomes more prevalent in terms of currency relationships as well as debt relationships. And that creates a real sort of over power base that's more multinational than simply being just dollar based. And so when China was first talking about getting into the SDR, the US was of course very against that. And they're still against it, but they just publicly said it was all right during the years. But it would prefer not to, I think, have had its power dictated or even moved a little bit by something the IMF is saying.
Now, you're here in Tokyo for the purpose of going delivering a lecture on Japan's relations in this changing Game of Thrones. And it is interesting to think about the way the Bank of Japan will situate itself as these alliances change, because clearly it has been reliant on the U.S. umbrella for the last 70 years in a lot of different ways, militarily and economically and financially and monetarily. And there is, at least it is coming into view, the conceivable idea that the Bank of Japan might realize that they might have more alliances with the PBOC as it starts to gain in power. You talk in the article, you say the alliance of the BOJ and PBOC has not been fleshed out yet, but I believe that's only a matter of time. Old fights might be discarded if economic or financial survival is imperiled, which is what these sharper market moves foreshadow. Tell us about the Bank of Japan and some of the things that are going on in the heads of people like Kuroda at this point.
Yeah, well, first of all, there is the prevalent policy, which is negative interest rates. And from what I've gleaned on the ground here, that policy will be in place for the foreseeable future. There is a concept here that it's starting to have some effect in terms of recent GDP growth here, and it just needs a couple, another year or two or something to stay relatively in that realm. But there's also a lot of conversation about, you know, how Japan positions itself relative to the U.S., in particular with regard to the Trump administration. And Trump ran on a platform of, and I don't necessarily think that's how it's going to fully unfold, but he ran on a platform of a lot of isolationism. And what that means is, whether it happens in practice or not, the way he operates is to do individual deals. That's how he's been a businessman. It's to basically divide and conquer. So now he will try most likely to have individual deals with Asian countries as opposed to, say, the U.S. being part of the TPP or something like that, which was dead under the Obama administration anyway. But from the standpoint of Japan, they're in a position where as this is unfolding on the U.S. side, they are in a position to have stronger alliances with China, which can be economically beneficial to both, even though they've had historical disagreements. But as I mentioned in that, that's something that, you know, when you want to grow your economy, you're not really sure what's going on with the U.S., with your old alliance, or with Europe, because Europe is having its own fragmentations with Brexit and other things that are occurring there. Then you go close to home. You go where there's a growing consumer base, a growing population, growing technology, growing sustainable energy infrastructure projects and everything else. So I think just from a standpoint of survival and growth, it makes sense to link in more with China. It also makes sense to take more of a leadership role with respect to South Korea, working with India, basically with respect to BRICS countries as well as the Asian countries to begin with, and not necessarily to wait until the U.S. decides to do something or be involved, but to just take the initiative outside of the U.S. And if there's also an ability or an opportunity to work with the U.S., that's okay as well. But Japan really has an opportunity now to be more of a leader, actually, in Asia than I think it's ever had before, given the shift in the U.S. And the rise in China. It has the opportunity to work with China and also has the opportunity to have a leadership role throughout the rest of Asia and even with respect to Europe as it stabilizes.
There is so much going on here that really is fascinating. But we tend to get caught up in the macrocosmic scale of all of this and looking at the central banks as these almost godlike beings that are, you know, deciding our fate. I always like to try to bring it down to the level of regular human beings and what they can actually do in their lives. There are disruptive technologies and ideas that are coming into view that would have been inconceivable 10 years ago, and who knows where they'll be at 10 or 20 years from now. Things like blockchain technologies that could truly find ways around the traditional banking structures as they exist. What is your sense of, not this in particular, but these types of ideas actually having an effect in disrupting the central bank's game as they're playing it?
I mean, I think that conceptually having an external source of currency that can be used by everyone is an interesting, it's a good idea. It's almost a globally democratic idea potentially, but I also fear some of that technology in terms of the transparency of it. If I'm talking about a real individual person and that's their only source of cash and exchange, it's not that the banks are better. It's not that the central banks are better. It's not that abdicating that control is better. But it's also not clear to me that, that this current alternative is necessarily safe. Actually, I was just a couple days ago in Tokyo. I met up with the fund manager who showed me a card that has a little gold gram on it. I don't know if you've seen these, but effectively, it looks like it's a credit card. It has a stripe on it, a magnetic stripe on the back, and there are certain places that take it, very few, but it's worth $60. It's a gram of gold. And just the same way you would use an Apple Wallet or something like that, or a car that's filled, you kind of use your allocation of that gram of gold, and it's connected to a real number for a real block somewhere else. It's I don't know what the company is. I think it's a German company that's created them. But that idea of having a connection to something real, but also using it as an exchange, I think could be another way of working outside of the general currency platform. And I would feel personally safer doing something like that and knowing that there's an existence of a real asset somewhere behind it. And I think that could be something that could take hold as well outside of these currency movements and the central bank lock. I think it's going to take a while. I mean, these are powerful players. They're shifting themselves. And they've been intransigent for a very long time. But I think the outside could be something that looks more like a hard asset connection than necessarily a blockchain, for me personally.
Right, yeah. Yeah, certainly people can tend to get hung up on particular ideas rather than sort of the general concept. So I think that's important to keep in mind. Tell us about the Artisans of Money.
So a lot of what we talked about is this rise of power and also shifting power of central banks. So when I wrote All the President's Bankers, it was looking at domestic and foreign policy from the standpoint of the relationship of private bankers, powerful private bankers over the decades and presidents and how they influenced each other with respect to the United States and its world, with the U.S. being centric. But the Artisans of Money is looking at the evolution since the financial crisis of how these relationships are breaking down and changing because of how the central banks took such a powerful role in dictating monetary policy, finances, market bubbles, economies on the ground that they've never had to this extent before in any of these countries' histories. Particularly not with respect to coordinated effort that emanated from the U.S. and became and is still a prevalent coordinated effort among central banks. So I look at the relationships of the people who are running these institutions, how they change, how they dictate what the decisions are, what happens publicly in terms of what we know about rates or what we know about actions and what actually has happened in the statements, because a lot of times, and I like to look at real information, the statements of a central banker and things that are sort of hidden within them, when you look at them from sort of future at the history, you can actually see in time what's going on. So if the Fed does something, but the People's Bank of China was saying something else to the press in China, but you start to move the time frames to overlap, you can really see what other countries think of each other in a way that you don't see if you simply look at one country. And so I'm just looking at that sort of time lapse and how that's impacted the national economies and real people on the ground in those, as well as the relationships on an international basis, how that's changed since the rise of central bank power in the post-crisis era, and also how it's going to change the very nature of these West to East alliances.
All right. Well, that's an awfully big thing to bite off and chew.
It's a little nuts,
I can imagine.
That's what I'm doing. Yes.
Well, good luck. I'm very much looking forward to it. So I'm rooting for you to get that finished.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
The Federal Reserve. The heart of the American banking system. For over 100 years, it has operated in the shadows, controlling America's money supply in total secrecy.
So all that information is available in our commercial paper
program. And who got the money?
Hundreds and hundreds of banks. Any bank or that has access to the U.S. Federal Reserve's discount.
Tell us who they are.
No.
Until now.
100 years ago, in 1913, the Fed was created.
Fractional reserve banking.
the legal authority to do it.
Takeover of monetary policy
are conducted by the Federal Reserve Banks. They are banks.
There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
Century of Enslavement, the History of the Federal Reserve. Watch the documentary for free at corbettreport.com/Federal Reserve and purchase a copy on DVD to help support the Corbett Report today.